Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Thanks for stopping by. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
always great to stop by.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. So I had a really great listener inquiry, and I thought maybe more people would fall under this category. She had a question for you, Senator Blumenthal. And in fact, I think she said she recently emailed your office about this. So she has I think it's her daughter, who works in South Korea. And she, unfortunately, because South Korea doesn't have the same capacity for what our country has for the COVID vaccine, her daughter's not vaccinated. And especially with the Delta variant and everybody being really concerned about it, her question was, why at least don't we have all the U.S. embassies outside of our country stocked with the COVID vaccine? Because not every family can just fly family members home who either are stationed elsewhere, are working elsewhere, are going to school elsewhere. So are there conversations about getting the COVID vaccine at least to U.S. embassies for Americans who live outside our country?
Great question, Melissa, and thanks to whoever asked it, and I look forward to seeing the email. The simple answer is yes, there are conversations, and a lot of it in the answer depends on what the host countries are doing, because we want all of those countries to provide vaccinations to their people as well as to United States citizens. But in the meantime, we should be providing greater availability of vaccines to our citizens through the embassies. And there are certainly conversations ongoing about it.
Yeah, because I thought the suggestion of like either the U.S. embassies or even, you know, like the nearest military facilities, why we aren't getting vaccines there. I know the president has been very open and pushing the idea of, look, let's get vaccines to other countries, because we know if they reach herd immunity, we'll stop COVID, essentially. I think the U.S. is under control enough that we're in the right direction to get rid of this thing. But as long as it's in other countries, we're not going to get rid of COVID. I was just curious, you know, what the latest on that, especially because we're trying to push the vaccine elsewhere. Why, you know, like U.S. embassies or military bases don't already have them stocked up?
A couple of points, Melissa. First of all, the State Department has been somewhat concerned about a backlash if United States embassies are offering the vaccine only to our citizens. A better strategy in terms of our support abroad, our image in other countries, would be to provide more vaccines to everyone for exactly the reason that you mentioned. As long as this virus is spreading and mutating, as long as variants are appearing more contagious and dangerous, we will all be in danger. So we have a stake in other countries adopting public health measures and providing the vaccine to everyone. But also keep in mind that this country is by no means out of the woods. Yes, Connecticut is at about 67%. That's a great measure of progress, but there's still parts of the state, including downtown Bridgeport or the city of Bridgeport, that are lower than 50%. Smaller communities, Plainville, Griswold, also under 50%. There's a wide variation. Hartford is under 50%. So we need to concentrate on this country as well.
No question. I absolutely agree with you, talking to Senator Richard Blumenthal. I think the thing, though, is at least I do feel like our country does. I mean, we're doing a boatload of incentives. I think in our recent news, I think Hartford just said it's offering now just like $250 to anyone in Hartford who hasn't gotten vaccinated. I mean, I think we're coming up with every way possible to make it available. So it's not a necessary of it's not available to people here. You're right. We're certainly not out of the woods, but we have the accessibility and everything. It's just a matter of how do you convince people to get the vaccine and how do you let them know where they can go to get it? Whereas if you've got people who are teaching across, teaching across the globe, or athletes who are competing on teams in other countries, or you've got missionaries or students or whatever the case may be, military members, you know, being able to get them the vaccine while they're doing a service in other countries and helping other countries, I think that's a little bit different.
I agree. And my points are not to detract from that one, but simply, Nick, we have a lot of progress to make here in this country. But you're absolutely right. U.S. citizens abroad doing public service ought to have that vaccine access. They are motivated to do it. They are potentially vulnerable to vaccine viruses in those countries. And we ought to seek more aggressively to provide them opportunities to get it.
Yeah, and not to put you on the spot, Senator Blumenthal, but I'm just curious, any idea how many vaccines at this point, I mean, it could be ballpark, how many we're sending out to other countries? Like, do we know at this point sort of a ballpark how much we've been sending out?
We know what the goals are in the millions, and I don't have an exact figure for you, but there are a lot of vaccines still well below what the need is, and that's why we're working with the vaccine manufacturers to provide them not only to this country, but others as well, persuading those other countries that they must make available this vaccine to people, their own citizens, is also a diplomatic hurdle. But to come back to your point and the listener, yes, we really ought to have those conversations about how best to make the vaccine available. And I'd be interested in talking to them and others. I have been talking to a great many of them about their friends and relatives who may be over there.
That would be great, Senator Blumenthal. So if there is anyone like Chris in this situation, if you're listening, Chris, Senator Blumenthal is going to look through his email, certainly, to see this. If somebody else falls under this category, it sounds like being talked about at the federal level, trying to figure out how do we get these vaccines overseas, obviously to everyone, but especially if you're an American who is serving another country of, you know, teaching, whatever the case may be, how do we get the vaccine to you? That sounds like it's happening at a federal level. So people can reach out to your office, Senator Blumenthal?
Absolutely. And my email, richard@blumenthal.senate.gov. Please be in touch.
Senator Blumenthal, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
And by the way, I am pushing Eversource to be better prepared for the storm that we're going to see tomorrow, because Connecticut consumers rightly simply won't tolerate a repeat of Eversource's negligent actions prior to Storm Isa Eas. With those disastrous results that we saw then, we ought to have better preparation, storm response. Consumers deserve it, and Eversource can and should provide it.
Yeah, it's a good thing, especially Senator Blumenthal. You're right. With the tropical storm last August, certainly something that people are fearing. But also even this morning, we're still looking at over 2,000 outages in Connecticut just from the thunderstorms in the last couple of days. So we're certainly hoping that Eversource and UI, their feet are to the fire, and that we have things restored and taken care of in a much timelier fashion. That's for sure.
Absolutely. You know, just after Tuesday, the storm hit with 25,000 customers without power. So we know better preparation is critical, staging the crews that are necessary, providing equipment, management on the ground. There are simple common sense steps, but Eversource failed utterly to provide them after the last tropical storm in order to do better now.
Senator Blumenthal, we appreciate all that you do. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
All right. News out of Norwalk Hospital, transforming its neuroendovascular and heart care for their patients, because now they have access to the latest technology to diagnose and treat neurological and cardiovascular conditions. This is huge news. This new system we're going to talk about with Dr. Joshua Marcus of Norwalk Hospital. He is a fellowship-trained neurosurgeon specializing in surgical treatment of brain and spine conditions. And good morning, Dr. Marcus. My understanding is actually you led the efforts to bring this new system to Norwalk Hospital.
Thanks, Melissa. That's right. So about 5 years ago, we launched our program here in Norwalk Hospital, and we were the first in Fairfield County to perform thrombectomies for stroke, so procedures where we can go up through the arteries to actually open up blood vessels in the brain to help people suffering from a stroke.
So tell us about this new system. Forgive me, I don't want to botch it, but a new biplane, is it angiography? How am I saying it? I know that's not right.
Biplane angiography.
Angiography, yeah. Dang. Okay, so what is that?
So that allows us to take x-rays of the patient's head simultaneously from the front and the side. So it's sort of using two separate planes to take pictures while we inject dye through the blood vessels in the patient's neck or brain to look at the blood vessels specifically, so that we're taking x-rays of this dye going through the blood vessels, and we can see the blood going through, looking for abnormalities or helping to treat abnormalities.
That's amazing. So what would you say are some of the advantages to now having this system that if we didn't have the system in place?
Sure. So this allows us now in Norwalk to be able to take multiple views of the blood vessels simultaneously. And for the blood vessels, which are fairly tortuous and make a lot of turns and twists, this is very helpful. So when we're tracking our wires and catheters, things we use to go up and treat stroke or brain aneurysms or brain hemorrhage, we can take better pictures, better quality pictures. This is a cutting-edge technology, sort of the first of this particular technology in the region. And so the quality is much better and the technology is much more advanced.
And I think, you know, I would imagine that you have less exposure to radiation, no?
Absolutely. So by taking these x-rays simultaneously, we can, with better technology, we can lower our x-ray dosage, so we can get the same high-quality images at lower x-ray doses. Also allows us to take to use less injections, so the contrast itself can have some, you know, risk to the kidneys in particular, and by injecting less contrast, we can lower that risk to the patient.
That's unbelievable. We're talking to Dr. Joshua Marcus at Norwalk Hospital this morning about this new system that is allowing patients to get access to be able to diagnose and treat neurological and cardiovascular conditions. I would imagine, Dr. Marcus, that people had to go out of state to get this kind of technology immediately. No, I mean, before it came to Norwalk Hospital.
Yeah, so for stroke in particular, patients were being transferred outside of the county for their thrombectomy, for their patients who are suffering from an acute stroke. And so there was a lot of time lost for patients to be transferred to other centers outside of this particular region. And so now, having had that technology here, again, to help patients suffering from, you know, an acute or new blockage, time is so critical that being able to provide it here is extremely helpful.
I mean, and when you talk about either a stroke, heart attack, things like that, I mean, how common is it? Like, how useful do you find this is going to be in Norwalk?
Extremely useful. I mean, stroke is one of the sort of leading causes of death and disability. And, you know, over the last few years, we've had tremendous advancements in treating patients, opening up blood vessels and restoring function. And so the more access patients have in the region to that technology, the way better off they're going to be. The significant decrease we're going to see, at least locally, in patients who have sort of permanent deficits from this devastating disease.
I think this is just unbelievable. This is, to me, this is life-changing, especially, you know, you don't even have to be somebody who, you know, has heart disease in your family or something. Again, stroke can happen to anybody. So to me, I think this is life-changing. Why do you think, Dr. Marcus, it took so long to bring it to Connecticut?
So, you know, I don't know. I think part of the difficulty in trying to launch it again, particularly in Fairfield County, was just finding providers, right? Finding physicians with this particular skill set. They exist at some of the bigger centers in the region, but coming to, you know, some of the local hospitals was tougher to find physicians with this particular training. And once we were able to secure doctors who can do this 24/7, 365. We were able to develop the technology and build the program.
Well, again, the big news this morning, Norwalk Hospital now providing more advanced endovascular brain and spine procedures for anyone who lives here in Connecticut. And I think this is huge news. Dr. Joshua Marcus of Norwalk Hospital, thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. According to national data, 1 in 9 girls and 1 in 53 boys under the age of 18 will experience sexual abuse or assault at the hands of an adult. 82% of all victims under 18 are female. Ages 16 to 19 are 4 times more likely than the general population to be victims of rape. or sexual assault. These are very daunting numbers. And again, if you have kids in the car, this might be one of those segments you want to go back to the podcast and listen to later. Stephanie Swantek is here of Bridges Healthcare. She's part of the Be Safe Project at Bridges. And Stephanie, I think this is a topic, while it is very uncomfortable, we have to address how to recognize if your child is experiencing abuse. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Yes. And again, trigger warning, right? So again, if you do it, like as Melissa just said, please turn the radio off, or you can go back to if you do have kids in the car. But I also want to highlight too, when we talk about like sexual abuse, rape, sexual assault, I also want to talk about molestation, right, and incest, and because that's also a very ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. And it also, part of what leads to this, especially if it's molestation, which means ongoing, maybe in the family, it's also a lot of family trauma, generational trauma. Mm-hmm. It happened to my mom. It happened to my grandmother. And so it's almost something that's passed on. And it's not, I don't want to say accepted, but it's something that goes on in the family and you kind of just move on. Mm-hmm. Or the family just doesn't get the help or seek the resources because they're unaware of the justice that they could receive.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Stephanie, I think one of the biggest things would be signs or symptoms to be aware of and to try and prevent this, because not all kids are going to just go to their mom or dad. It's a very uncomfortable thing to say, hey, this is what's going on.
Again, especially if it's someone in the family, and especially if, as you mentioned, right, there are higher numbers within females or those who identify as female, but this happens to boys as well, in regards to like the body being sexualized, a lot of victim blaming, right, but also silences someone. But as you mentioned, right, some general signs, right, increasing nightmares and sleeping differences or sleeping patterns, withdrawn behavior or angry outbursts. Not wanting to be left alone, so that fear, maybe so increased kind of neediness as maybe a parent would see it as. Sexual knowledge or language that seems kind of inappropriate for that age, or maybe acting out. Let's say they have dolls, or they're playing doctor, and they're doing things that you're like, they shouldn't be touching down there, or sticking things up, right, in different areas. Mm. Simulating intercourse during play, and maybe talking about the body as being like dirty, and then kind of having fear or trouble trusting adults, or again, wanting to be alone with adults, maintaining, you know, or having difficulty developing relationships and then what I see in a lot of young people, in the teen range is if this has happened to them, kind of prior to the age of 12, a lot of them now, at even age 15, 16, have many, many sexual partners. And a lot of times they're being used and abused by their sexual partners. They feel like someone loves them, but they don't know what the difference is. They don't know what healthy is. And so when someone's using them for their body, if that's all they know in regards to good touch, quote, unquote, bad touch, affection, they don't see the difference. So just being... Yeah, so again, engaging in high-risk sexual behaviors, hypersexual activity.
So, Stephanie, you bring up a really great point. Stephanie Swantek of Bridges Healthcare here. You know, a lot of kids will start dating in middle school. It wasn't a rule in our house. We were supposed to date no earlier than junior year of high school. But a lot of kids start dating in middle and high school. And what, you know, unless you're a parent like my mom, who was a helicopter, you know, parent and had to meet every parent, had to walk us to the door, had to call parents ahead of time. I mean, she was very in our faces about it. And again, you know, growing up in the 90s, that was very common. I'm curious, you know, if you're a parent and you think your kid is in a healthy relationship, like you like the partner, you think they're nice, you it seems like your kid is just kind of like the angsty teenager, but is happy. What would you say to that parent to maybe dig a little deeper? Like, shouldn't we assume that you could be 14, 15 years old and know how to abuse your partner? It's not like that's just an adult thing. Like, domestic violence isn't just something you'll see in adults. Teens are capable of abusing each other.
Yes. But the thing to understand and see, or highlight is that the abusive relationships, whether it's sexual or psychological, et cetera, happening within young, you know, teen relationships, et cetera, is that usually it's connected to something they've seen before, right? So if I have a child partner has, you know, has come from a family that, you know, parents are in and out, there's a lot of fighting, toxic relationships, They are now taking that on and embodying that and then applying it to their relationships. And again, talking about like angry outbursts, right? That looks very different. So that angry outburst could also be applied to now my relationships. No one's listening to me at my house. I'm seeing people get hurt in my family. No one's listening to me. And so it trickles down to other relationships.
Mm. So is it okay, Stephanie? You know, I guess, how do you do that? How do you have the conversation? If they think they're in love, I'm in love with this person, but you're seeing the red flags. You're hearing what's going on in that person's household, and you're thinking, my child could be in danger. How do you not alienate your kid because they're in love, right? How do you not alienate them, but you also are like, hey, I'm here, and we got to address this if this is a real problem?
So the more... It's almost like the less you say, in a way, the more you can just model as much as we can healthy relationships in your household. That child is more apt to see a healthy relationship as I should be feeling this. And when they don't feel or see something and they're feeling something else that's completely new and bizarre and uncomfortable, they're going to feel and see the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more from the beginning, from early, early age, that we can have those relationship talks, you know, really communicate with our kids, the more they're going to understand what healthy communication looks like and when it doesn't look like. And so, again, it decreases the chance of them getting, like, taken advantage of or in these toxic relationships.
Stephanie, this is a really heavy topic. If there are parents or grandparents, aunts, uncles, people who want to learn more, how they have these conversations, how do they address it? Is there a way they could contact you at Bridges Healthcare?
Of course. My direct line, 475-202-2827. And again, I do want to highlight, like always, that as soon as a child's able to articulate and they're able, they know that they're starting to speak, they know what language is, they're utilizing language, is when we need to be actually even talking about our body parts. Because when the child knows who should be touching even their body parts and what those body parts are called, then they're going to know if someone is touching them, they're going to know that they can go to their parent who has taught them, you know, how to utilize these skills so they're not going to be shamed and it's not their fault. So again, that's also a very strong tool that we can pass down to our kids.
Stephanie Swantek of the Be Safe Project, we always appreciate having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.